So for tonight's speaker meeting, we have Catherine from the Ready, Willing, and Able and New Day Home Groups as our speaker tonight. Please give her a warm up.
I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 5/25/21, or 1,592 days, or 4 years, 4 months, 8 days. A little bit about me. I am one of five kids. One of the cool things about my parents is they met and got married 10 days later. My mom had a set of three kids, and then she met my dad and had me and my other sister. I'm the baby, so I get away with everything. And I am originally born and raised from Key West, Florida. My mom was born and raised there. My grandmother was from there. So a lot of close-knit family stuff. Living and growing up in Key West, it's a very small island, and everybody knows everybody, and you're related to everybody. So good luck getting away with anything. Let's see. Book's too far away, I can't see it. I was married for 23 years to my kid's dad. He passed away in March of 2019 from suicide. And I was not an alcoholic before that. I did not understand alcoholism. He was an alcoholic. I couldn't understand why he just couldn't quit drinking. You know, why can't you quit drinking? Why can't you do it for me and the kids? And he tried and failed and tried and failed. He never found AA, which is a shame. But after that day, it wasn't just, you know, a suicide thing. It was a whole media circus that day because he was a very big person in the automobile business for Priority. So a lot of people knew him. It was all over the news. My kids were known locally, so, you know, everybody knew what was going on and tried to call me. The cops took my phone. I couldn't have it for the rest of the day. but after that day, after a couple weeks of, you know, just, I call it work mode, getting things done, the house, the funeral, paperwork, all that stuff. You might need one. is when I started drinking to ease the pain because I didn't want to deal with that day. I didn't want to think about life without him. You know, what am I going to do with him without the kid, you know, for the kids? You know, how am I going to do this all by myself? You know, and I had my two sisters who lived here locally, you know, that would help me with whatever I needed and were there for me during that time. And so was my best friend. But at nighttime, I was alone. My kid had gone to sleep, you know, he was in school, and then it was, you know, the thoughts would start creeping in, so in order to make those thoughts creep back out, I would drink, and it progressively got worse. I was a normie before that. You know, I could look at something, a drink or a beer, and just be like, eh, I don't want it, or I could walk away half of it full and be fine, and, so slowly, over a period of time and then rapidly, for the next 2 years, I drank alcoholically. And I would fall down, get black eyes, have bruises. I didn't know, remember where I got them from. Didn't remember what I said the night before. You know, or my kid would ask me something. I'd be like, yeah, sure. And then, you know, the next morning, I'm like, where's my $100? And it's like, yeah, you told me I could go shopping or whatever. And not remember a thing. And I tried the controlled drinking. I would buy, liquor was my, drink of choice because it was quicker. And I would, you know, I would buy a bottle. I started out with the pint and graduated to not the gallon, but the bigger one. And said, you know, I'll only drink half of it. That was my thing going into the store. I'm going to drink half of it now. And then I'm saving money because I have the other half for tomorrow. And I'd wake up the next day, and it was all gone. Mm-hmm. And I would not have remembered drinking the whole bottle. And so my family was on my back and things like that. And I was dating a guy. And I was at his house. I was living with him, me and Chris. That's my younger one. And him and his brother were fighting, and it was just chaos. And I don't do chaos. I don't do fighting. I don't do chaos. And it was just too much for me. And I called my sister, who I used to call the judgy one. She's no longer the judgy one. I realized she was actually my rescuer. I called her up and I said, "Can you come get me?" And she said, "I'm on my way." And she did not know the living conditions that we were in. I went in and told Chris, "Pack what you can, we're leaving." And he went, "Finally." And I got to my sister's house and I was just pacing back and forth. And I kept telling, I didn't know there was a psych center. I just kept telling her, "I need to go to the hospital. I need to go. I need to go." Something in me told me, "You need to go to the hospital." Oh, I got to backtrack. When I was at that house during the chaos, my higher power, when I didn't know it was that at the time, but my higher power said to me, "You do not belong here." It was not my voice. It was that voice. And that's what Amy had that moment of clarity and called my sister and said, "Let's go." So anyway, I was pacing back and forth and telling her I needed to go. And she finally, you know, she was like, "No, you're fine. Just go lay down, go to sleep." And I just kept going back and forth. And she finally got tired of it and said, "Fine, get in the car." Which is good that I didn't give up and bugged her to take me, because my alcohol level was so high. I sat in that lobby for 8 hours waiting to, you know, get a bed. They probably should have sent me to the emergency room, but they didn't. And I was so bad off that I was 50. I was 50 years old that I needed a walker because I could not hold myself up. I was so shaky and so weak. And I spent the next 3 days in bed. They would come down and get my bottles because I just could not make it to the nurse's station area. And I walked around with a blanket all the time because I was so skinny and so malnourished and just tired. And it was so cold in there. It was February. And you know, I got good stuff out of that program. And I met a few people. One of the people that I met kept sending me texts and all this other stuff. It happened to be a guy. And like 6-8 months later, we met and we started dating. And then shortly thereafter, like a couple months, I guess, he enabled me, you know, it was my choice, but he enabled me. He's like, "Let's have a drink." And, you know, I didn't know any better. I hadn't gone to a meeting, hadn't really done anything except a little program after the psych center for 2 weeks, and didn't continue on with going to a meeting like they tell you to do. And so we drank together for 3 months or something, and I didn't know it at the time. My kid has told me since that he used to hit me. I would have bruises, and my kid would come in and see him, you know, like have hold of me and stuff, and he'd be like, "What are you doing? Get away from my mom," kind of thing. But the one time I do remember is we were in the car, and I was driving. Maybe we were parked, I don't know. But anyway, I was in the driver's seat, and he hauled off and punched me in the face. I mean, like, full-on punch. My face swelled up. I kicked him out of the car, and I drove off drunk. And he called me up, crying, you know, "I'm sorry I did that. Please come back and get me." Of course I did. And then, you know, I got home, and my kid saw me, and he kicked him out. And my kid at the time, 14, I think, kicked him out and called my best friend, who was male, and said, you know, "He hit my mom." And he came and got us and took us to my sister's house, where I stayed until, because he was living with me, he got out the house. My best friend went over there, who was a sheriff deputy. He's a really big guy. The guy I was dating at the time was a big guy too, but my best friend was bigger. And said, "You got an hour to leave, or I'm coming back and you're not going to like it." So he left. And I got my apartment back, and it was a mess. And I went back to rehab, because that was the deal, just, you know, be at my sister's house. So we stayed there for 2 weeks, and I went to rehab, or the psych center. And then started doing that IOP program again, too. I don't remember when that time frame was, but I ended back in the psych center a third time during Thanksgiving, which really sucked. I missed Thanksgiving with my family. And that really hurt, you know, bothered me. Sadly to say, it didn't, you know, kill me from drinking again. I drank again, and I went back into the psych center almost 2 years later to the day and told them, I said, okay, obviously this isn't working. And the IOP afterwards, because I had done that 3 times. I need something more. I think I need something more. And they gave me 2 choices, somewhere locally and an awful place called Galax, Virginia. And I say it was awful because the facility is a rundown old hospital. The lady that was like the oldest person I've probably ever seen that still continued to work was born in that hospital. That's how old the hospital was. And it was February, and it was freezing, and it was moldy. And I had rheumatoid arthritis, so that was not good for me. I missed my treatment because I would get infusions. I missed my treatment for that month, and I was going to miss the next month, and I couldn't miss another month. And the only good thing about that facility is out of all the counselors that they had, which I don't know, it was probably 10, one person was one of us, and he could relate to us. And his class was the one that was most popular, and then the patients. I got the most out of him and the other patients because we were all very supportive of each other. And the good thing about that place is at nighttime, you either had to go to an NA meeting or an AA meeting. And the NA meeting was down in the basement, which was cold, and the other one was in the regular building that had some heat. So I went to AA. And that's where I learned how it works and how, other, you know, heard out how other people shared, how their lives were. Still had yet to meet anybody that their spouse or somebody close to them had committed suicide. So I still felt like I was unique. I came home and that was in 21, and I drank for another 5 days shortly after that and stopped drinking and avoided my sister because I always felt like I was being judged by her. She was doing her best to help me as best she knew how, but I avoided her. And then I finally went over to her house. She lived right not too far from me, like I was next door. And it was the first time I said to anybody, I need help. And so she called the local hotline and said, okay, this is the deal, what do I do? And the psych center said, well, she's already detoxed, she can't come here, but we suggest you contact this psychotherapy place. And she did, and I agreed to go there. Luckily, one of the counselors that was a counselor at the psych center had moved to this company, and she became my therapist, my counselor. And I did that for 3 months. I did it from Monday through Friday from 9 to 3. And it was right after COVID hit, so it was all online. So I didn't have to leave house. I didn't have to get out of bed. And it was good because it was such a small group, because it was during the day and I was not working, that a lot of times it was just me and another person and the counselor on the Zoom, or just me and her. So I got a lot of one-on-one time. And during that time, I learned a few things. I learned a lot about myself, but I learned a few things that are a big part of my story. And it was, I learned how to say no and just shut up, because I'm a people pleaser. So I would, somebody would ask me something and be like, yeah, sure. You know, you're like, what are you doing tomorrow? Oh, nothing. And then I'm hooked into doing whatever it is that they need done because I want to help. And I learned how to say no, to things that I really didn't want to do, or be a part of. And I also learned I don't have to say anything at all. I don't have to respond. I don't have to be invited to every argument, conflict that I'm invited to. I can just walk away and not say anything. You know, I don't say, well, I'm walking away and leave. No, I can walk away. And the first time I said no was big for me, because they asked me something and I said no. And they're like, okay, I'm going to go ask so-and-so. And I was like, that's what I've been missing this whole time, is, you know, freedom. And then, you know, the next day after I did that, when we got online, I told my counselor, I'm like, guess what? And she's like, what? I'm like, I said no. And, you know, she's like, how did that make you feel? I said, well, it made me feel bad at first, but then it was so liberating. And I said, and I took it a step further because I'm an overachiever. And I said, now if I'm saying yes, why am I saying yes? Am I saying yes for them, or am I saying it yes for me? You know, what's the reason behind my yes? And a lot of times when somebody asks me something, I'll pause and see how I want to respond before I respond. And I didn't learn pause until I got here. And when I first got to New Day, many times, is when I was sitting in the chair, you know, you have to introduce yourself, you don't have to, but you introduce yourself as a newcomer, and I did. I did not want to say I was an alcoholic because I did not want to be one of y'all. I was not one of y'all. I did, because I really correlated alcoholism with my late husband. You know, I wasn't that bad. And so I would introduce myself. I'm Catherine. I have a problem with drinking. And after being there for a while and learning I am one of y'all, damn it, I finally introduced myself as, you know, I'm an alcoholic. And I started to share. I did not have a sponsor yet, but I met some people in there. I was afraid to be at home by myself. And I met, you know, some women in the group, and one of these ladies that I met, I told her about that, and she says, well, I can come stay with you, you know, tonight. And I'm like, well, can you stay for a while? You know, I said, I really need somebody during the day when my kid's gone, because that's when I drank at school. My kid was at school. And she's like, yeah, sure. And the plan was for her to stay there for 2 weeks, and she ended up staying there for over a month until she had a car accident, and she had rehab and all this other stuff, and eventually moved out. But admitting that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable is true, but I did not want to admit that because I didn't want to say I didn't have control over my life. Being married for 23 years, I was described myself as a married single parent because that's all my husband did was work, and he came home and he drank. And then he'd pass out, he'd wake up, he'd go to work, he'd come home, drink, pass out. And he usually only took one day off a week, which was Sunday. And Sunday was football day or golf day on TV. And, you know, we would go to church, come home, and he'd crack open a beer. And so me and the kids would find things to do, you know, go to the mall, go to the movies, football, hockey, whatever. So I didn't, you know, I didn't want to be him. I don't want to be that alcoholic. But I found out that there's other types of alcoholics that, you know, they're an alcoholic, they just didn't have that suicidal tendency. And not being, you know, not wanting to say that I was powerless over something was hard for me even to say, and even to let go of that control of, yeah, I am powerless over alcohol. Because I controlled everything that happened in the house, you know. It was, you know, kids would ask, oh, go ask your mom, or it was ever what I wanted to do, or whatever I wanted to go eat, or go shopping, or whatever. It was all on me. And so saying I was powerless over alcohol was a big step for me to say. I mean, I already knew my life was unmanageable, my life was a shit show, and, you know, driving intoxicated, driving intoxicated with kids in the car, you know, and I didn't think about it. I even showed up to my kid's school after school one day to pick him up from school, drunk in the parking lot, and he wouldn't get in the car with me. And I tried to fight him, make him get in the car. And he says, I already called Aunt Janie to come get me. And she lived, you know, between the school, it was her house, and then my house. So I knew she was on her way. I needed to get out of there. She was going to call the cops, and I was going to get arrested. So I left. And that probably is how I got into the going back into the psych center one of those times. So once I got into the rooms and everything and started learning things, still didn't have a sponsor. I didn't have a sponsor until I came out of Galax and was doing the IOP thing. Right after Galax, and hadn't started the IOP thing yet, because during that short amount of time is when I drank, and I called my sponsor drunk, and she's like, okay, you know, you're going to stop drinking tonight, and you call me tomorrow. And then it took me a couple extra days to talk to my sister about more help. Came to believe in a power greater than myself, could restore me to sanity. That was my spiritual encounter that first time. I already had a relationship with my higher power, whom I call God. But, you know, being intoxicated that much and actually having that moment of clarity when I heard that voice, I didn't realize it until way later during step work that that was my first spiritual encounter. And I was like, oh my God, that was it. I actually had one. I was like so excited I had a spiritual encounter. Mm-hmm. And then made the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. You know, like I said, I already had a relationship with him, but giving over my will and letting him, you know, his will happen, you know, being the control freak that I was, it was hard to do that. And we talked about that in my counseling sessions. And I'm a visual person. I get pictures in my head a lot of times when people are talking. And it's just like, you know, a snapshot of stuff. And sometimes it'll play out into a little reel. But she said, I know you're a visual person, so I'm going to give you this scenario. She goes, you drive everywhere you go, don't you? And I was like, yeah, because I can leave when I want. I don't have to wait, you know, for somebody to give me a ride or whatever. I don't have to call Uber. And she said, okay, you need to get out of the driver's seat. And I was like, what? I'm not doing that. Because my late husband, he drove everywhere, and I could sleep in the car. Ever since then, you know, I was afraid. You know, I was afraid of the ex come in. You know, I had just had all these fears because my safe person was gone. And then this abusive guy came into my life. And, you know, it got so bad when me and my kid, you know, we had this stick thing under the Brink stick under the door. And, you know, we'd open the door and look out and make sure he wasn't in the hallway. We would open the stairwell, make sure he wasn't there, get downstairs, make sure he wasn't out in the parking lot, get in the car, go wherever, make sure before we got out in the car, nobody was, you know, all those fears of getting ambushed was real high. So letting go of control was like, I'm not doing that. And I don't know, well, some of y'all are young, but Inspector Gadget or one of those, Dr. Smart or whatever, Maxwell Smart things where you had mm-hmm. the steering wheel and it to go to the other side, like a pilot thing, pilot steering wheel. That was the visual I got. You know, she said, you can't move the steering wheel when you're in the passenger seat. And I was like, crap. And it took me a while to do that. And then I finally had the visual of me sitting in the passenger seat and that other seat empty, but we were still going somewhere and I was safe, almost like Tesla now, but before that. Happened. And also, you know, made a decision to turn my will over. I make decisions all the time, you know. It's like the joke of the three frogs on the log or whatever. I made a decision months ago to go to the gym and start walking on the treadmill and stuff. I still have not gone to the gym. John gets up at 4 or 3 o'clock in the morning every day to get to the gym at 4:30 so he can walk his, you know, hours worth of walking. And, you know, I'm like, I'm going to go with you tomorrow. No, tomorrow's never come. I'm not getting up that early to get to the gym. I can go some other time during the day. Still haven't gotten there. So a decision without action is just thinking. That's my definition, my version of, you know, if you don't take action after that decision, you're just brainstorming or thinking or blowing smoke. My will over my life, I have a very strong will. I'm determined, I'm hard-headed and headstrong. An overachiever, you know, just like, you know, tell an alcoholic they can't do something and they'll say, watch this. That was me, you know. I'm a very, I like tools. So an idea, you know, a little thing for you. I go to Lowe's or Home Depot and I'm standing in the aisle looking for whatever it is that I need to do. I need to repair whatever thing I need to repair in my house because I was a handyman. And I knew how to use tools. And you know, an older person would come up and go, can I help you with anything, ma'am? I'm like, and I would immediately get offended. I'm like, no, I know what I'm doing. Thanks. You know, just, you know, they're trying to do their customer service thing. And I'm offended because he asked a woman, you know, like I, and you, you know, don't know what I'm talking about or don't know what I'm doing. And I can complicate the simplest of tasks, you know. Should I tie my shoes, you know, rabbit around the tree or two bunny ears? I don't know how to do two bunny ears, but I mean, you get the idea. You know, I can, and I'm a list person, I can overcomplicate a grocery list. You know, I want to get my stuff and get out. But then I could spend hours walking back and forth the aisles trying to find that next thing on my list. Overcomplicating things. And I want to do everything perfect. That comes from my dad being a Navy chief. You know, it wasn't the white glove inspection, but it was close to it. You know, we didn't have to bounce a quarter off our bed or anything like that. But, you know, if we washed the station wagon and missed a spot, you know, when it was time, okay, Dad, we're done, and he'd come inspect it, and we missed one little spot, we had to wash the car all over again, the whole thing for another hour and a half. And because, you know, you had to wash it, rinse it off, dry it, all that kind of stuff. So we had to do it all over again. So we learned very quickly to do it right the first time and do it perfectly. So that, you know, led into childhood with grades. I didn't have to study. I didn't have to bring home homework, which really pissed my sister off because she had to, because it didn't come as easy to her as it did to me. But, you know, I rarely ever had homework. And even in my jobs, I wanted to be the best. I wanted to be, you know, the boss. I wanted to be the leader. And it's just because that's how we were raised. Let's see. And this one, sorry. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. I say that step 1, 2, and 3 are when you get with your sponsors for you to get to know each other, and for me as the alcoholic, as the sponsee, to learn to trust her with some information and build that rapport and over time and everything to get to know them. Even though I've known my sponsor, I knew her in the meeting for a year and a half or so and would just go up to her and say hi to her and hug her for the day and leave. When I was looking for a new sponsor, I knew I wanted her to be my sponsor. And I walked up to her one day and I said, hey, can I ask you something? You know, I did it in a really quiet voice. I'm not quiet. I'm bold. I can get in your face, that kind of person. I'm not afraid of confrontation, but I was afraid to ask her to be my sponsor because I was afraid she was going to say no. And she knew, you know, how I am about my higher power, and I knew that she had a different one. And I asked her, I'm like, would you be interested in being my sponsor? And she's like, well, we need to talk about that. She goes, you know how I feel about God? And I'm like, yeah, I'm not asking you to be my priest. I'm asking you to be my sponsor. And she's like, okay, cool. I figured you'd say that, but I just had to put it out there. So that's how that relationship worked out for me. You know, I hear different people saying, you know, when I first got into AA, I thought going through the steps was a competition. You know, I would hear other person, well, I'm on step eight. And I was like, I'm only on step 2. But with this sponsor, you know, all the other sponsors that I had previous to her, I describe now as all of those sponsors, because I never got all the way through. I think I got up to step 6, was all surface level, you know, just kind of scratching the surface. And with her, it really got into the undergrowth, you know, deep down in the dirt, to the root of the cause of why I was alcoholic, why my behavior was this way. And it took me over a year and 3 months to get through the steps. And then after the steps, we did the traditions, which I was like, okay, we're going to do the traditions, yay. But then once I got into the traditions, I figured out that I like the steps, but I love the traditions. Because we really got into it. She really explained it well. And now we're doing, you know, she's like, well, what do you want to do after that? And I'm like, well, we've done steps and traditions. Let's do the principles. So now we're doing the principles, and it's a lot of fun because we're figuring that part out together. Because she's like, okay, I had something else planned, but yeah, let's do that. Whoops. So the exact nature of my wrongs, and I'm also a word person. I love definitions. People that know me know about that. Exact means correct and in every detail. The exact nature of my wrongs, not just, you know, some of this, some of it, I used to drink, but I didn't drive, I left that part out, or I did drink and I drove, but I left the part out where I had my kids with me, that's not the whole truth. Nature, the basic quality, character, or fundamental essence of something, going beyond a general description and grasp of specific facts and attributes, the trait and quality, and to gain complete and accurate picture, leaving no room for doubt or uncertainty about the subject's fundamental reliability. So I had to, in my fourth step, write all my stuff down, and then I had to go over it with her, and I had to be completely honest and be exact of what my nature of wrong was. And talking about the fourth step, in my line, we don't do columns. We do like a worksheet kind of square thing. And she made me focus on the first question. And then once I listed all the people that I was pissed off at or who I was pissed off at, then I could move on to the next question. Well, how did they wrong me? And I would say all that. And then we got to the part where it was, because I didn't continue to look at the rest of the questions as we went along. And then we got to the question of, well, what was your part in it? And I was like, who are you looking at? What was my part in it? They made me mad, not me make them mad or me do something to make them, She's like, no, you had a part in it. And that's where I say really got to the, nitty gritty of it. That dug down deep is because I had never looked at my part in it. And when it got to the point for me to do the amends and everything, the people that I needed to do amends on, I didn't have a relationship. One was my late husband, who I couldn't, physically see. And the other one was the male best friend that cut me off and stopped talking to me after I went to Galax. Because he says, I can't anymore. I can't watch you destroy your life. And I can't keep doing this yo-yo emotional thing with you. And you go to rehab, come back, and you do good, then you relapse, go back to rehab, come back. He's like, I can't do it anymore. It's killing me. So during, during my amends and everything and doing that stuff is when I learned to have compassion for my best friend and why he cut me off and things that I was pissed off at him about. I had a part in it, and I actually had compassion for that. And then I had compassion for my husband. And it was very eye-opening, and it really helped me, bloom a little bit more as an alcoholic member of AA. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. The seven deadly sins, asked him to remove the shortcomings. All those things, the selfishness, the rage, the anger, all those things, some of them are assets and some of them aren't, not rage and anger, the ego can go both ways, look at me, look at what I'm doing, don't look at me, don't look at what I'm doing, it has to be, right in the middle. You can't go either way. You have to have balance there. And I didn't understand that until I got into AA. There's so many things that I've learned since becoming an alcoholic. And I talked about step eight. And the thing about step eight is I became willing to make amends to them all. Doesn't mean that I had to act on that amends. Because when it was time for me to do that, to write those letters, I couldn't get started because I had the fear of the confrontation that I thought in my mind I was going to have with that best friend. And I just, I couldn't get past that fear to start. And it was like the beginning of December when I was supposed to start that. And then, you know, she got sick and then Christmas was happening. I'm like, well, why don't we just pick up in January? My alternative desire there is like, I don't want to start. I haven't started. I don't want to disappoint you that I haven't started. So when we got back together and I'm like, okay, I got to be honest with you. I haven't even started a letter. I've had all month to do it and I just can't. And she goes, well, what's the holdup? And I told her that. And she goes, okay, well, let's just take that off the table. Let's just say you're not going to see that person. We know you're not going to see your late husband. So you're not going to see him either. Because we meet at a bakery shop every Wednesday in the morning. And I said, if he walked in here right now, I would sink into the corner being like, oh my God, there he is. I hope he doesn't see me. Kind of thing, because I was just afraid of that, you know, rejection and then acceptance and the crying and, you know, all that stuff. And she says, okay, well, just take that off the table, because I knew where he lived, of course. You know, I had the thought in my head, I go stick the letter in his door, and he has a ring camera, and he sees me, what are you doing here? Or open the door and be like, get the F off my property kind of thing. So I just couldn't do it, the fear, the anxiety. And she took it off the table, and I was like, she's like, so we're just going to write the letter like you're never going to send it or see him or whatever. And I was like, oh, okay, I could do that. But I had to have that other person saying that simple thing for me to understand I can do this. And that's the cool thing about AA is you actually have somebody to support you and who has been through that. She had gone through the same thing and was able to continue on with the steps. So she, you know, had the path for me. I just had to follow her. Major recommends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others, harm their spouse, harm their kids, harm the person. My best friend, the guy, best friend, him and my older son grew up together. They played football together. So we were very integrated in his life. The night that my husband died, we spent the night at his house because we didn't want to go our place. I was good friends with his wife, and of course I was his best friend, and so we spent a lot of time there. My younger one thought of him as the son of him, as another brother, just a bonus, and so I knew I wouldn't harm his kids or harm his spouse, but it might harm me. I wasn't one of those kind of people that cheated on somebody with their friend's husband or somebody's husband or anything like that. So, you know, anything like that. But, you know, if I was employed and, you know, my employer didn't know why I went away and then I just confessed, hey, this is why I was, you know, if he could have gotten fired or whatever, stuff like that. Continue to take my personal inventory. And when I was wrong, I promptly admitted it. I need to remember, I can only take my inventory. I can't take Ralph's or Thomas's or Mike's or anybody like that. I gotta remember to take my inventory. And that was huge for me too, you know, because I called my sister the judgy sister. Because I thought she was always judging me for how I lived my life and what I was doing. And she may have been to a certain extent, but you know, she was my older sister. She's 15 years older than me. So growing up, she was a mother figure to me. So I shared all aspects of my life with her. When I needed advice, I called her. When my youngest got cancer, she's the one that I called. And one of my sisters met me at the hospital and sat with me all night while my husband was at work and didn't come. And when it was time the next week for us to go up to Washington, D.C. for this surgery, my sister went with me, the judgy one, went with me. Because my husband, we had just taken spring break, and he had already taken a week off, and then this happened right before we left for spring break, and it was like, okay, well, I can't take, you know, more time off, because we need to go to Washington for this surgery, even though his job was telling him to take off, go ahead, you're fine. He didn't. And so my sister went with me, and they didn't tell me before I got to the hospital. Ronald McDonald House is an awesome charity, by the way. I did not know about them until we got there. The doctors down here set up the whole thing. They said, here's the address, you go there, they'll take care of everything. And when they say take care of everything, they mean we got there, they had a care package bag thing for Chris with t-shirts, a stuffed animal, some toys and, you know, stuff to get, you know, they make up these things to get the kids' mind off of stuff. And we had an appointment the next morning to go meet the doctor, and it was, you know, Ronald McDonald House is in, you know, a sketchy kind of neighborhood because that's where they're at. And it was at Georgetown University or something, like way far away, which I hate driving to Washington because it's worse than Hampton Roads. And that was nerve-wracking enough just getting to Ronald McDonald House. I could not imagine having to go find this university in more unknown terrain. And I told the girl at the desk, I'm like, you know, where is this place at? She's like, oh, we'll get you a lift. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, how do I pay for that? She's like, oh, no, we got it. And I'm like, well, how am I going to get back? She goes, you call me and let me know you're ready to come, and we'll send one to pick you up. And it was like a 30-something dollar ride one way. And I was, like, amazed that they did that. And then they had food, breakfast, lunch, and dinner for everybody that was there. And just an amazing place. And then the next day we were scheduled, 2 days later we were scheduled for surgery. They had somebody pick us up and take us there, and then pick us up when Chris's surgery was over. And he actually stopped at the pharmacy and waited for us while we got our prescription. And it was just an amazing experience. And then after, you know, we had to go back up there because Chris's leg got infected, and they did the same thing all over again. Just a great charity. But, you know, I had to remember to take my inventory, and, you know, that's in AA is where I learned, you know, different visuals for me is, you know, worry about your own square. I can't step into your square, you can't step into mine. Well, you can, but there's not going to be room. I learned boundaries. Some people, my girlfriend says it's her hula hoop. I can't, you know, it's hard for me to wrap my brain around it because I can't do a hula hoop. I'm not coordinated enough. But I can understand, you know, a circle, a boundary. And while doing that counseling, my extended counseling with the company after I drank and detoxed myself is where I learned I did not have to have all my family members in my circle. I only needed the people that were in my house and my older son who lived on his own by then. And because my sisters were in my circle too, and I thought, you know, because it was a pattern throughout my whole marriage that the people that I talked to was typically my older sister because she, you know, was retired. And, you know, I would call her up and, you know, like, hey, what are you doing? You know, I'd tell her what I was doing. The kids were getting off. I'm like, I'm coming down because my son, we had moved to Yorktown, but he was still involved in football. So I would drive down every night for football in Kempsville. And, you know, I'd drop him off at football practice, maybe run to her house for dinner and come back and pick him up for football. So, you know, really involved in life, and you know, she would tell me what I, you know, what she thinks she, you know, I should do, and I would normally do that. And then once I became an alcoholic and got in rehab and everything and started to learn how to do a regular life, I didn't know how to cut her off. And I had to learn to put her outside my circle. You know, I could have a whole bunch of circles that were just expanded on, like, you know, in the daily reflection, how it has that ripple thing, you know. It's just my inner circle is just the people in my household and my kids. Taught through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, and the power to carry that out. Sought to seek prayer, meditation, talking, and listening. And for me, my higher power, I do Bible study in the morning, and, you know, talk to my higher power then. But a lot of times if I need to have a conversation, I talk to him like he's sitting in the car next to me. Sometimes I'm yelling, sometimes I'm cussing, but there's still a conversation going on in there. And then he talks to me through pictures and sometimes dreams. And but being able to, you know, acknowledge that and see that. Let's see. The meditation and listening, nothing else, only knowledge and power, a power's ability, strength, and confidence. And then 12, carrying the message, having had a spiritual awakening. We try to carry this message to others and practice these principles in all our affairs. And that's where I learned principles before personalities. In New Day, we have plaques everywhere, these wooden things that somebody made that has the 12 principles on it. And one of them is principles before personalities. Another one is progress, not perfection. And I learned the progress, not perfection first, because that was a big issue for me. And then it was principles before personalities. Because in a meeting in the sister fellowship, there's a woman that introduces herself really loudly. And it just is like, you know, nails on a chalkboard for me. And I told my sponsor about it. She goes, well, maybe you need to ask her, you know, why she does that. And I was like, that's not why I told you that. I don't want to ask her. She says, well, maybe you need to. It took me 8 months to ask her. I saw her at a convention, and I'm like, and, you know, I was getting that nudge, and I'm like, oh, fine, I'm going to go ask her. So I asked her, and I said, you know, my sponsor told me to ask you why you do that. You know, is it because you're excited about recovery? Is it, you know, a thing? And she was a little offended at first, and I said, well, I just want to know why you do it. Because she has a great message after she yells. And she said, well, she thought about it for a minute. She goes, well, when I first came in, you know, I was really excited about, you know, that I was clean and sober, and I was just really excited to be alive. She goes, and now it's, I don't know, it's 10, 15 years or something. And she says, and now it's just a thing. And so I saw her, you know, she came to a couple of meetings after that, and I noticed that she had toned it down a little bit. And, you know, because people were making fun of her in the room, and I don't like it when people make fun of somebody else like that. You know, I used to work with special needs kids, and, you know, a lot of times they would get picked on and come in and crying and stuff like that, and it really used to really irritate me. I hate it when somebody gets ignored, like homeless people. I don't, you know, they're people too. They're just, you know, have an issue or something. You know, you don't need to spit on them or walk by them or ignore them when they're asking for help. You know, learning, I would say early on, when I finally got comfortable with sharing, things about myself, that I would not change anything about that day that my husband killed himself, except the day, you know, except that he killed himself. Becoming an alcoholic is the best thing that ever happened to me, because I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about other people. I learned how to live life on life's terms, because, you know, just because you become an alcoholic doesn't mean life is going to always be great. It's not. It's just when the storms come, I know how to handle them better. I don't have to drink over it today. And that's all I worry about is just today. I don't worry about tomorrow. I've dealt with my past. I don't worry about that either. But I, you know, learned to worry about just today. And then when tomorrow comes, I worry about tomorrow. And that has given me a very happy life. I'm very happy today. I never thought I would get married again, because I wasn't going to get hurt like that again. But I ended up getting married again to somebody in the program. A lot of y'all know him. But I've never laughed more in my life or smiled more than my life, except when I jumped out of an airplane with a parachute. That was like an amazing day, jumping out of an airplane, skydiving. I smiled for 3 days, and it was the best high I ever had. So if you're new here, keep coming back. You will hear your story in here. I did hear a story. I was chairing a meeting one day at New Day, and a girl shared about her brother, who she was very close to, who committed suicide, and she was talking, and I was looking at my husband, and I was looking at her as she spoke, and then I look at him, like, you know, the eyes, like, oh my God, are you hearing this? And she was telling her story, but it was my story too. And we spoke after the meeting, and I haven't seen her in a very long time. Hopefully she moved away, but at that meeting, I learned that I was not unique. You know, I learned other ways I was not unique, I was not special, but that, you know, I thought nobody's gonna have my story. But somebody had a story similar to mine. So, if you're new, or, you know, fairly new, keep coming back, do step work, find a really good sponsor, get numbers of the same sex, and use those numbers You know, I got tons of numbers that I never used. You know, they'd give me a meeting list after with numbers on it, and I'd go in the trash. But now I use the phone today. I call my girlfriends, and all my friends are in recovery. And I talk to two friends at least a day on the phone, and, you know, just to see how they're doing, how I'm doing. And it keeps me sober today. Thanks for the share.
Thanks, Catherine. So our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside donations. Money collected at this meeting covers donations for the church and supplies. The rest is given to the Tidewater Intergroup District 24 and the General Services Office. Besides this meeting on Tuesday nights, in the other building at 8 p.m., we have a book study. Right now we're in there 12 and 12. Are there any other announcements?
My name is Steve Roach, and I am an alcoholic.
Hello, Steve.
At this home group, the International Group, on November 14th, next month, we're going to have our first annual gratitude dinner. It's going to be in the big room, and we have